The headlines this hour. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says normalizing ties with Israel cannot bring about security for the occupying regime. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has targeted U.S. bases in Syria in response to Washington's support of Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Also coming up, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel has failed to achieve any of its objectives over the past 100 days, despite committing genocide in Gaza. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says Israel's normalization of ties with some Arab countries in the region will not bring about security for the regime. Addressing an international conference on Gaza in Tehran, Raisi said that the Israeli regime should end occupation of Palestine and should be punished for its occupation. He stressed that the occupation will not bring legitimacy for the regime. Referring to the regime's ongoing genocidal war in Gaza, he said the Israeli regime has not achieved any of its goals after 100 days of aggression on the Palestinian territory. More than 100 prominent Islamic scholars are participating in the event, dubbed the International Conference of Al-Aqsa Storm and the Awakening of Human Conscience. The Israeli genocide in Gaza has reached 100 days. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 1 in 20 Palestinians in Gaza are dead, wounded, or missing. Gaza has a population of 2.3 million who face Israeli massacres and destruction on a daily basis. Health officials said the Israeli occupation forces killed 135 people in the past day alone. That brings the confirmed overall death toll to over 23,800 people. Some 60,000 have also been injured. Schools, mosques, churches, hospitals, and ambulances have been a frequent target of regime forces, which have left only a handful of the medical facilities partially operational. Palestinian officials say only six ambulances are still in operation in the entire Gaza Strip. The World Health Organization had previously said that Israel attacked hospitals and other vital medical infrastructure nearly 600 times during its genocidal attacks. Hamas's armed wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, has released fresh footage of its attacks on invading Israeli troops and military vehicles in Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip. In the latest attacks, Qassam said it targeted at least seven Merkava tanks and several other military vehicles. The Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, said that it targeted several Israeli settlements. Its fighters also fired anti-tank missiles at regime forces in central Gaza. In the meantime, Israeli media have reported that some 4,000 soldiers have suffered disabilities since the beginning of regime's onslaught on Gaza. The report added that the number would likely rise to 30,000. The Israeli regime has admitted death of 187 of its troops. However, Gaza's resistance groups say the regime is underreporting its casualties. U.S. military bases in Syria have once again come under attack by resistance forces. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq said it launched two drone strikes at U.S. bases in northeastern and eastern Syria. The group also claimed responsibility for a rocket attack on another U.S. base in northern Al-Hasakah province. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq has carried out a number of such strikes in response to the U.S. support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. A senior Hamas official says Israel has failed to achieve any of its objectives in Gaza despite the regime's genocidal war.
We underscore that the occupation has not succeeded in achieving any of the goals which it declared ever since it began with the aggression on the 8th of October. Despite all of the genocidal crimes they are committing and which have led to more than 24,000 martyrs, most of them women and children.
The Hamas representative in Lebanon said that Israel has failed to break the determination and the resistance of Palestinians. He said the resistance forces continue to carry out operations against Israeli troopers, despite the regime's onslaught. Hamdan said the Israeli regime has dealt a strategic loss on October 7 and will continue to suffer failure after failure. He made the remarks in a presser marking the 100th day of the Israeli war on Gaza. While the Israeli regime continues its atrocities across the Palestinian territories, regime forces have stormed several areas in the occupied West Bank. Now, in the raids, they abducted sisters of martyred senior Hamas member Saleh al-Aruri. Our correspondent Monica Kandil joined us earlier for more details.
It's weird that the Israeli forces detained in, let's say, two different operations near Ramallah this morning, where the Israeli soldiers carried out a pair of overnight raids in Ramallah, specifically in the village of Arura, the hometown of martyr Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri, and Al-Biri near Ramallah. And the Israeli forces had detained Dalal and Fatima, the sisters of Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri, who was assassinated by Israel in Lebanon earlier this month. Up to the moment, there's no comment from the Israeli military whether why they had detained the sisters, but it's very clear there is an Israeli campaign against the Palestinians, even against the expression of opinion. Because when Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri was assassinated, those two sisters had spoken in the public accusing Israel of the assassination of their brother, speaking about the Israeli aggression and the non-stop raids of the occupied West Bank.
Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has launched new strikes against Israeli forces. The group fired missiles at a gathering of Israeli soldiers at a house in an Israeli settlement near Lebanon's southern border with occupied territories. Hezbollah says the attack left casualties. This operation came as Israeli forces killed four resistance fighters who were heading for the occupied territories. Tensions remain high across the Lebanese border as Israel and Hezbollah continue exchanging heavy fire. The regime forces frequently launch attacks on areas in southern Lebanon. In response, Hezbollah conducts retaliatory attacks by striking Israeli troops and military positions across the occupied territories. And as our correspondent Mariam Saleh reports, Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says it retaliates against Israeli troops any time they launch attacks on the Lebanese territory, particularly in the civilian areas.
Hezbollah has made it clear whenever there is an area which is anywhere near civilians, or perhaps their livestock is also targeted, the agriculture is targeted, then Hezbollah makes that retaliation where they launch sometimes Katyusha rockets, sometimes other missiles, but basically against the settlement as a whole. But throughout the other times, of course, most of the attacks are against specific military targets. Yesterday, they clearly said that there was one tank that they had monitored. It was always the one that was targeting, bombarding with its projectiles all the towns surrounding the area of Mutale, which we're talking about, Kfarkila, Khiyam, Marjayun, Adaisi. These are towns that were targeted by that Merkava tank, and Hezbollah said that they successfully targeted and hit and perhaps destroyed even that Merkava tank that was in the area of Mutale.
More rallies have been held worldwide in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza, with protesters calling for a ceasefire. Thousands rallied in the U.S. Capitol, urging President Joe Biden to call for a ceasefire. In the Italian city of Naples, 5,000 symbolic tombstones were laid out to remember the Palestinians killed in the conflict. Protesters called for an immediate end to Israel's bombardment of Gaza. Hundreds of Iraqis took to the streets of Baghdad, demanding a ceasefire, while waving Palestine and resistance movement's flags. Also, tens of thousands gathered in central London in front of the parliament, voicing their support for people in Gaza.
The Israeli regime's genocidal war in Gaza is ongoing. So is the public campaign to try and stop it. A 500,000, many of them young people, from across the UK, descended upon the capital, London, to push the government to act on their demands.
Definitely a ceasefire in the short term, and then ultimately end of occupation.
It's absolutely despicable that our country and our political representatives cannot reflect our views and show that we firstly want a ceasefire and secondly want to use some kind of influence to working towards a peaceful solution.
We want an immediate ceasefire and an end to the occupations.
The march comes hot on the heels of U.S.-UK strikes on Yemen, and a day after the International Court of Justice heard a landmark genocide case against Israel brought by South Africa, a case the U.K. government did not support.
U.K. governments for decades have been complicit in failing to hold Israel to account and thereby supporting the sustenance of his system of apartheid. But this is a particularly egregious episode in that history of complicity, because what we are complicit with now is a genocide.
Among the diverse crowd, healthcare professionals who know all too well the impact of the relentless U.S.-Israeli bombardment of the civilian infrastructure in Gaza.
I think what we're seeing is a systematic targeting of the healthcare system in Gaza Strip. And in fact, the entire infrastructure and supply of things that are needed to keep a population alive. If you just think about you, for example, and what you need to stay alive, you need water, you need food, you need shelter. Depending on, you know, your living situation, you need electricity. And if you're unwell, you need a hospital. And those are all the things that have been systematically targeted.
What's striking about this protest, as with the previous ones, is not just its sheer size, but also its youthfulness. Young men and women energized by the knowledge that the pressure that they have brought to bear over the past 3 months can contribute to a change in the policy of the British government on the ongoing Israeli massacre of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
This is the first national pro-Palestine demonstration of the year. Organizers say as long as the bloodshed in Gaza continues, so will their campaign. Saeed Pourreza, London.
On Saturday, thousands of people took to the streets of the Italian capital to stage a rally in support of Gaza and the Palestinians. The initiative, dubbed Stop the Genocide of Palestinians, was joined by a string of organizations representing social partners, including base unions and humanitarian associations, and people from all walks of life.
It is appalling how the media ignore these initiatives, how the people's understanding of what's happening in Gaza is shaped by lies. Despite that, many people are here today.
Many at the rally stressed the importance of South Africa's submission to the International Court of Justice, accusing Israel of committing genocide in Gaza.
Although the ICJ is notoriously biased, it is important that a country that has suffered apartheid for decades, like South Africa, has filed a genocide case against Israel.
It's a new Nakba. We have already seen tens of thousands of displaced Gazans. Sadly, history repeats itself.
So far, the Italian government has unrelentingly sided with the Israeli regime. This despite hundreds of pro-Palestine demonstrations across Italy over the past months. On January the 1st, Italy began its one-year presidency of the Group of Seven major industrialized powers. Earlier this week, the Italian Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani said that G7 members are working with the Israeli regime to secure a rapid end to Tel Aviv's onslaught in Gaza and reduce the civilian casualties.
My long militancy on the side of the Palestinians has taught me not to trust words, only actions matter. Let's wait and see. It could just be a mere propaganda strategy by the Italian government.
On Saturday, besides Rome rally, a dozen more demonstrations in solidarity with Palestinians were also held in many other Italian cities, including Milan, Turin, Florence, Genoa and Pisa. Max Civili, Rome.
We are all Palestine!
Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria have taken to the streets of the Nigerian capital, Abuja, slamming the Israeli bombardment of innocent Palestinians in Gaza. They said since October 2023, Israel has dropped over 30,000 bombs in Gaza, resulting in the death of thousands of civilians.
They have destroyed a lot of places of worship, markets, schools, hospitals have been destroyed. And the world is keeping the defining silence of the world is amazing. And that is why we are out to mark this 100 days and call for total ceasefire and call on the other nations to do like Yemen, South Africa and other nations that says no to injustice.
The demonstrators said Washington is also complicit in Israel's crimes because of his continued support for the regime. They slammed Washington for sending weapons and ammunition to the regime and vetoing UN resolutions that call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
You have destroyed their home, you have killed their parents. You see a child who lost all his family members, and you are saying they must go back to their homes. Where is the home? Which home? The home that has been destroyed. The 70% homes in Gaza has been completely destroyed by Israelis, with full support of America.
The demonstration ended with the burning of the flags of both the U.S. and the Israeli regime. The demonstrators said the recent U.S.-UK attack on Yemen shows the extent of the complicity of the two countries in the non-stop genocide against Gaza. They expressed hope that the Israeli regime will face justice at the International Court of Justice for its atrocity crimes in Gaza. Benjamin Abdullahi, Abuja.
Thousands of Israelis have once again rallied in Tel Aviv to protest against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over his failure to secure the release of captives in Gaza. Well, the protesters urged Netanyahu to resign and call for holding early elections. They vowed to continue the protests until all captives are released. Netanyahu has been in hot water over his handling of the Gaza war. Israel has so far failed to release any of the captives by military means. It has also failed to achieve any of its stated goals. Israel has been the scene of anti-Netanyahu rallies for months. The Israeli prime minister has been charged with fraud, bribery, and the breach of trust in three cases filed in 2019. A literary forum was held this Saturday in the Syrian capital, Damascus, to pay tribute to the martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and his comrades who paved the way for the victories achieved by the resistance.
With the participation of 70 poets from Iran, Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen, Egypt, and Kuwait, the Iranian embassy in Damascus organized the first international festival of resistance poetry, Rhymes of Victory, to pay tribute to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and other martyred commanders of the resistance front. The forum highlighted that words are stronger than bullets. Participants emphasized that such activities are vitally important to document with literature and poetry the shining pages of the struggle and victories achieved by the heroes of the resistance front in order to preserve their legacy for the next generations and consolidate the culture of resistance in the collective awareness in the region and the world. Political, academic, religious, and popular figures attended the ceremony to express their solidarity with Palestine and the resistance front, and to honor the martyrs on the path to liberate Al-Quds. At the end of the festival, awards were distributed to contest participants for the most inspiring poems about the resistance.
Poetry has always immortalized the feats of heroes throughout history, so how could it not praise legends like Haj Qasem Soleimani and his companions, who sacrificed everything to protect their homelands and defend the justice? Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. In the United States, the former President Donald Trump has been ordered to pay the legal fees of the New York Times for a failed lawsuit. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. A judge in New York has ordered former President Donald Trump to pay nearly $400,000 to cover the New York Times legal fees from a now-dismissed lawsuit he brought against the newspaper, three of its reporters, and his niece. Donald Trump sued the New York Times in 2021, accusing the paper of conspiring with its estranged niece, Mary Trump, to obtain and publish his tax records. New York Judge Robert Reed dismissed the lawsuit against the New York Times and its reporters in May of 2023, ruling that they were protected under the First Amendment and ordering Donald Trump to cover their legal fees. On Friday, 12th of January, Judge Robert Reed determined that $392,638 was a reasonable value for the legal services rendered, given the complexity of the case and the attorneys involved. A portion of the lawsuit against Donald Trump's niece, Mary Trump, was allowed to proceed, and her request to be reimbursed for legal fees was denied in June. In 2018, the New York Times reporters Suzanne Craig, David Barstow, and Russell Butner published an investigation into Donald Trump's wealth and taxes, revealing details from tax filings the former president had been unwilling to release publicly, claiming they were under audit. The newspaper later won a Pulitzer Prize for its reporting. Today's decision shows that the state's newly amended anti-SLAPP statute can be a powerful force for protecting press freedom, a spokesperson for the New York Times said on Friday, 12th of January, referring to a law meant to discourage frivolous defamation cases aimed at silencing defendants. The court has sent a message to those who want to misuse the judicial system to try to silence journalists. Donald Trump claimed in his $100 million lawsuit that the reporters were aware of a settlement agreement barring Mary Trump from disclosing certain documents. He alleged that the newspaper and the reporters engaged in an insidious plot to illegally obtain copies of his tax records from his niece. A spokesperson for lawyer Alina Hubba, Donald Trump's attorney who represented him in the case, did not immediately respond to a request for comment. When Judge Robert Reed tossed the lawsuit last year, Alina Hubba said, "All journalists must be held accountable when they commit civil wrongs. The New York Times is no different, and its reporters went well beyond the conventional news-gathering techniques permitted by the First Amendment." Another national broadcaster, ABC News, has also covered this same story. A New York judge ordered Donald Trump to pay the New York Times $392,638 in legal fees on Friday, 12th of January, following the former president's failed lawsuit against the newspaper. In 2021, Donald Trump sued his niece, Mary Trump, the New York Times, and three of its reporters over an alleged breach of a confidentiality agreement related to his tax records. Donald Trump alleged that the reporters were motivated by a personal vendetta when they engaged in an insidious plot to get his personal tax records. New York Supreme Court Justice Robert Reed dismissed the case last year, clearing the way for the New York Times to recoup its fees. Courts have long recognized that reporters are entitled to engage in legal and ordinary news-gathering activities without fear of tort liability. as these actions are the very core of protected First Amendment activity, Judge Robert Reed wrote. Donald Trump opposed the amount of money requested by the New York Times, arguing that the legal work included unjustified or duplicative work and exorbitant hourly rates. Considering the complexity of the issues presented in this action, the number of causes of action, the experience, ability, and reputation of defendants' attorneys, the considerable amount of dispute, and the attorney's success in dismissing the complaint against their defendants, the court finds that $392,638 is a reasonable value for the legal services rendered, Judge Robert Reed said in a decision posted on the court's docket on Friday. Meanwhile, weather continued to impact the schedule of presidential candidates heading into Iowa caucuses, as former President Donald Trump has now cancelled 3 of his 4 in-person commit-to-caucus rallies. Instead, Donald Trump will hold a series of tele-rallies and is still expected to go forward with his in-person appearance at his commit-to-caucus rally in Indianola, Iowa. In a video message posted on X, formerly known as Twitter, Donald Trump said, "I'll get there sometime around Saturday night. One way or the other, I'm getting there. You have the worst weather, I guess, in recorded history, but maybe that's good because our people are more committed than anyone else."
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kabit Akwai. The U.S. and the U.K. have attacked Yemen, hitting over 70 targets in that country. Now, the reason that was given? To stop the Yemeni army from targeting vessels traveling in the Red Sea. That's Israeli-linked, although the Yemeni army has been very clear that it only targets these Israeli-linked vessels and ships. It has hit back at the U.S. for the attack, saying that the Yemeni army's actions is to stop the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war. But is the U.S.-British attacks on Yemen a way to distract from the genocidal war that's taking place in the Gaza Strip? And if that's the case, does it also point maybe to the failure of the Israeli regime when it comes to not being able to defeat the resistance fighters? Those are just a couple of the angles we'll be looking at in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. Joining us in the studio is David Yahoubian, professor of history at the California State University at San Bernardino. Also joining us, Chris Williamson, former British MP and host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified, who joins us from Derby in the UK.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both, gentlemen. And I'll start with you, David, if I may. Taking a look at just what has transpired in the past hour or so, we had Osama Hamdan in Beirut pointing to the fact that Israel has pretty much not been able to achieve the goals that it wanted and has, in a sense, been defeated on that in that regard because it couldn't defeat the Palestinian fighters, namely Hamas. Also, you have the Israeli Prime Minister who, in a press conference, has said that based on the ICJ and how that went down, that we're going to continue with what they call their onslaught in the Gaza Strip. But they both point to the fact that they have been defeated, that Israel has been defeated, along with the U.S., which is masterminding this. What is your reaction to the fact that approaching 100 days, none of the goals that Israel and the U.S. wanted have been achieved when it comes to their genocidal war on the Gaza Strip?
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me. I don't think that the goals that Israel has laid out are achievable. They have neither achieved their goals nor will they be able to achieve these goals. They will not be able to defeat Hamas or the Palestinian resistance. They thus far have not been able to achieve their military goals. They haven't been able to successfully have a release or exchange of hostages or refuse to. So their stated goals have not been met. And I believe that the predominantly U.S. and U.K.-led attack on Yemen is simply an effort to distract world opinion from what's going on, especially not just what's going on in Gaza, but what's going on in The Hague related to what's going on in Gaza, and to somehow try to spin or to change the narrative, when in fact all this is doing is bringing greater attention to the enabling of this genocide by the United States of America, and now with assistance from the UK. So, in short, the effort is to spin, to try to show some sort of resolve, when in fact all this is doing is pointing out in sharp relief the direct support, now direct kinetic support, of the United States and the UK for the Zionist onslaught and genocide in Gaza.
So what do you think about that, Chris Williamson? I guess the key point made there, one of them anyways, is the fact that the possibility of the U.S. and the U.K., attacking Yemen to divert attention from the failure that's going on there, the defeat, really, of the Israeli regime forces. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think David makes a very pertinent point. Clearly, the Israeli occupation forces are not making the progress that they'd anticipated. We know that Britain and the United States have been giving support to the Israeli regime, providing military weapons and so on, and steadfastly refusing to take any action to bring about a ceasefire. And these attacks that have been launched against Yemen, there is no provision in international law for these airstrikes. I mean, it's, you know, in many ways you could argue a case of international terrorism. And indeed, if, in terms of, you know, international law, Yemen, I would argue, is actually in compliance with international law, in compliance with the Genocide Convention, which actually provides for nations to take action to stop a genocide from taking place, or indeed to prevent one from happening. And all the evidence points to the fact that clearly a genocide is happening before our very eyes. I mean, billions indeed, not millions, but billions of people are actually witnessing it on their smartphones and on their PCs. And so clearly it seems to me what we're seeing now is an attempt to divert attention. And, you know, you mentioned the International Court of Justice, where, you know, if the evidence is followed, it's very clear to me that, you know, at least a prima facie case has been made out. And that would have a very serious very serious consequence, not just for Israel, but for those that have been, you know, making it possible, as it were, for, you know, collaborating in that genocide. And I think it's certainly arguable that the United States and the United Kingdom, with the support that they've been giving, both morally and indeed practically, with weapons and so on, and indeed, it's even been suggested that there are British and indeed American special forces on the ground in Gaza, and the British government issued what's known as a D notice to suppress information being reported in the media about the special British special forces involvement on the ground there. So, I very much agree with the point that David was setting out there.
What stands out with what Chris Williamson said there, David, is the fact that Yemen was actually adhering to international law with what it has set out to do in terms of wanting the stated goal to be to stop this genocidal war that's going on. And when he said that, it kind of brought back the stated goal of the UN, where back in 2005, and I just did a quick Google search, the R2P doctrine, where it states UN members endorse the responsibility to protect, which states that countries have a responsibility to protect their citizens. And if they fail to do so, that responsibility, and this is the key part, falls instead on the rest of the world. So do you think that the fact that Yemen has said, we're going to target Israeli-bound ships unless this genocidal war stops, the siege is lifted, and then aid is also allowed to come in, that they are actually, in a sense, then adhering to law, just like our guest Eric Quist said?
That is an interesting point. I would say that Ansar Allah is directly applying the R2P doctrine. Of course, this doctrine, the responsibility to protect, often invoked and utilized by liberal interventionists in the United States or the other side of the coin of neoconservatives to legitimate attacks and the destruction of nations such as in Libya. But I would say that this would be a pure and just case of the responsibility to protect. And I'll just add on the point that the United States and the British, by being directly complicit in this genocide, by not only underwriting it, funding it, giving the diplomatic protection, but now engaging in kinetic activity against the Yemenis, depending on what the ICJ determines relative to the question of genocide, the United States and the British are then going to be deemed complicit with the genocide, if this is what the ICJ determines. And so, therefore, in the context of what's been going on in the last few days, this could be the U.S. and the U.K. attempting, in some pathetic way, to preempt the ruling. In other words, once the ruling happens, it would be very clear that they were bombing Yemenis and killing some of the poorest people in the world in support of a genocide. But until that court ruling comes out, there is potentially a little bit of interpretive leeway for them to therefore engage in this, and the terminological shenanigans of that this is important to defend maritime commercial shipping, which is just absurd and sure. Pathetic.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
The scale of the attack, however, Chris Williamson, in a sense, I think, puts into question what is the UK and the US after. We're looking at about 72 to 73. If the latest attack, which was reported a few hours back, we put that at 74. If it were just some rocket launchers or pads, which they were, then maybe we would say, okay, they're not really going after anything more than that. But the scale of the attack maybe points to the fact that they want the Yemeni army to not have the deterrent power, and therefore perhaps the some that are speculating that they may want to take over that area, which is the Bab al-Mandab and the Port of Hodeida, in order to take control basically of the Red Sea and the transit routes there. Do you think that is the intention of the U.S. and the U.K.?
Well, certainly, look, imperialist powers like, you know, Great Britain and the United States, you know, have a record, don't they, going back, you know, in Britain's case, you know, several hundred years of using its power to, you know, impose its will. And I'm sure that's certainly what they would like to achieve. However, you know, it's not as straightforward as, you know, some people might think, and certainly the way in which some of the corporate media commentators in the West are sort of portraying this. I mean, you know, they're not taking on a ragtag of, you know, irregular sort of militia here. You know, we're talking about a heavy-duty military in the case of Yemen and Ansar Allah. I mean, you know, they have, you know, significant weaponry at their disposal and, you know, won't be as straightforward. And in terms of the will of the Yemeni people, it's very clear from the rally that we saw, a huge rally in their Sana'a city, with people expressing their absolute solidarity with the Palestinian people and indeed support for the action which is being, you know, taken in support of the Palestinian people to, you know, as you pointed out, their target ships, which are, you know, Israeli ships and shipping, which is bound for the Israeli regime. But, you know, let's look at the United States record. I mean, you know, they've you know, talk about the rules-based order and international law and all the rest of it. And, you know, use this as an argument to justify their action against Ansar Allah and the, you know, these airstrikes. But, I mean, just look at what the United States, one rule for them and one rule for everybody else. It was only last year they seized an Iranian oil tanker. A few years previous to that, they seized four Iranian tankers that were bound for Venezuela because they said that they were breaking the sanctions. The sanctions, let's remember, that the UN Special Rapporteur described as tantamount to crimes against humanity. These are the sanctions being imposed by the United States on Venezuela. So, you know, they have no room to talk. And as I said, you know, there could be very, very serious consequences.
Okay, looks like we just lost your audio there, Chris. I'm sorry, we can't hear you. Let me move to you until we get that fixed. We lost your audio there for a second. Hold on to your thoughts while I go to David. David, taking a look at how the U.S. and the U.K. Have attacked Yemen in this case in point, and we're not too sure how much further this is going to go at this point. Yemen has said that they're going to retaliate, if I were to read the words of the Hossein al-Ezzi, the Yemeni deputy foreign minister, who said the U.S. and Britain must prepare to pay a heavy price. This may go on. But the question that comes about here is the U.S. and the U.K. in this so-called coalition that they have actually over there, which was, you know, wasn't really received that well, mm-hmm. especially when you have Saudi Arabia and the UAE, for example, saying we don't want to be part of that, is that they're afraid that this strategy might actually work. Do you think that is the case? Because if you really think about it, Yemen has stood up. They've really stepped up to the plate. And the strategy that nobody would have thought, they've conjured that up and they went after it in terms of targeting Israeli-bound ships. How effective do you think this strategy is, and if the U.S. in particular is afraid of this actually working?
I think clearly it is working. I think it is not only working, but it is working as intended, and therefore the percentage of shipping arriving at Eilat port has dropped essentially to zero. And so it is working. It is working both physically as well in terms of the, let's say, how to describe it, the global opinion viewing the actions of Ansar Allah in, as you said, and as we could call it, utilizing an approach that could be considered R2P to protect Palestinians. This is directly effective in achieving the desired goal, which is motivating the Israel to stop its genocidal onslaught on the Palestinian people. Now, certainly the Israeli economy has been hit hard by this. The United States and the British and this weak, loose coalition, they're trying to put this forward as just a general attack on maritime trade and shipping, when Ansarallah has made it clear that this is directed only at Israeli or Zionist-affiliated shipping. So again, in short, to answer your question, it is effective physically. It is also effective in terms of the information war and the narrative war, if you will, that is critically important, and in terms of maintaining the vast majority of world opinion on the side of the Palestinians and on the side of Ansarallah in this case. So in its concern over the success of these actions, we see now these decrepit imperialist powers attempting this pathetic kinetic attack on Yemen, in attempt to somehow change their policy. This is absurd. I think anyone who is a regular observer of politics in the region, say military developments in the region, is well aware that the United States and the British are not going to be able to achieve their goals, and they are headed into yet another quagmire that. The only question will be how many lives are lost and how much blood and treasure is expended by them in the process of them.
Well, it sounds like the sentiment that you just said is shared by so many people, like the images we're going to see now live coming from Washington, D.C. There's been a pro-Palestine rally. If we could take a look at that and see how many people have come out and what they're saying. Wow, that looks pretty big. This is live coming through from Washington, D.C. People have gathered there, demonstrations there, calling for the ceasefire in Gaza and end to the U.S. attacks on Yemen. And it's, Chris, pretty amazing, I should say, that the people have embraced this. Naturally, they should. I mean, that really, when you take a look at the genocide, but also the fact that they also came out for what the U.S. and the U.K. did in its attack on Yemen. And I think London also obviously experienced a huge rally today. The aerial shots, the drone shots, were testament to that. Tell us the role that the people in general have played when it comes to this genocidal war, in terms of what it did, maybe the divisions that it caused, et cetera, just to take a sidestep, since we just showed some of these this massive rally that was happening in Washington.
Well, I mean, I think what's happening is that the people of the world are united in their solidarity with the Palestinian people. Many people, millions of people, who were unaware of the Israeli regime's utter brutality. You know, the apartheid regime, you know, the daily indignities that they inflict on the Palestinian people are now known by people who previously were unaware of this because of the way in which, you know, the media tends to censor a lot of this information. But of course, this information is now getting out through social media, on people's smartphones, on their PCs, as I was referring to earlier on. And that's why we're seeing unprecedented numbers of people week after week turning out all over the world to express their support for the Palestinian people and their revulsion, their horror at what the Israeli regime has been inflicting. And, you know, I think this will, well, I think it's certainly concentrating the minds of certain politicians. I mean, they are completely out of step. Certainly the Western political class is completely out of step with the public at large. I mean, some of the European countries, for example, have gone as far as to ban pro-Palestinian demonstrations. But in spite of that, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are still turning out in defiance of the law which has been passed in those lands to try and suppress that expression of solidarity. And so this is, I think, we're going to see elections, unprecedented numbers of elections, I think, around the world. And I think many of the politicians who have thrown their lot in with the Zionist entity will pay a very heavy price. And I think this will also weigh on the minds of the judges sitting in the International Court of Justice. It should do. I mean, the case is overwhelming. And, you know, what could happen, you know, if that that decision goes the way indeed it should do, is it could lead to Israel being suspended from the United Nations. It could result in Palestine being admitted as a full member. It could result in an international criminal tribunal being established to prosecute the Israeli officials who are responsible for ordering this genocide, but it also has implications, as I was mentioning earlier, for those who are complicit with the genocide, and that includes politicians, particularly in the United Kingdom and the United States of America, but also really right across the Western world. You know, they really, I think, will be looking over their shoulder, and you know, the course of history could indeed turn very favourably in favour of the Palestinian people and could be decisive in terms of the future of Palestine and the future of the Zionist entity. This could be a pivotal year, it seems to be, in the Palestinian struggle, which, as we know, has been going on now for well over 70 years.
Indeed. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. We have to end it here. Thank you so much, Chris Williamson, former British MP and host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified, and also David Yahubian in the studio. Pleasure to see you. Professor of History, California State University, San Bernardino. Thank you so much to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikavi Tarveh and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La
ilaha illallah. Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have Brother Suhail to answer today's questions. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum salam. Thank you for having me.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
A Okay, Brother Suhail, for today's discussion, we want to talk about Mus'haf al-Fatima. What is Mus'haf al-Fatima?
So, the most prevalent question about Mus'haf, this Mus'haf, the most tumultuous and confusing issue is, what exactly does Mus'haf mean? The assumption is that this Mus'haf is a special type of Quran. However, in the following statements, you'll see that no, Mus'haf generally means pages between two covers in Arabic literature. And we have seen that, we have seen a lot of, we have this history, in fact, that some Sunnis had come to Qom to see the Mus'haf in a way thinking that Mus'haf Fatima is the Quran of the Shias, apart from the Quran that the Sunnis have. But when they come over here and they realize that the Quran of the Sunnis and the Quran of the Shias are same, and Mus'haf Fatima is something completely different.
So Mus'haf al-Fatima refers to the Holy Quran?
No, the connotation, the mistake connotation that had come into the Ummah right now was this, that Mus'haf, the word Mus'haf itself means Quran.
Yes.
You see, it was taken because Mus'haf was named Quran, so they thought Mus'haf al-Fatima meant Quran as well. And because of this connotation, they came into this meaning that Mus'haf al-Fatima is a Quran. But we have seen that there's proven that whenever the imams were asked in regards to Mus'haf al-Fatima, they were saying that Mus'haf al-Fatima is anything except Quran. It doesn't have anything from the Quran in this Mus'haf. They were, these were the answers of the imams of our times. Some of the hadiths about Mus'haf Fatima have used this very word Mus'haf, in which case the aforementioned thoughts are reinforced. For example, Muhammad ibn Muslim narrates from Imam Jafar Sadiq saying that Fatima left a Mus'haf which is not the Quran. Ali ibn Sa'id narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that, and it is with us. So by Allah, Mus'haf Fatima does not contain a single verse from the holy book of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, meaning the Quran. Imam As-Sadiq says that in it, what is like your Quran, only three times. So here when he says that in this riwayah, in it is what is like your Quran, only three times, he means the size of the Mus'haf of Fatima is like the Quran, the size of the Quran, but three times. But he doesn't mean that it's the verse of the Holy Quran. The connotation of Mus'haf means the sheets of text between two covers is called Mus'haf. In Sahih Taj al-Lugha and Sahih al-Arabiyya, it says, Al-Jami' li-Suhuf al-Maktub bayna dafatain.
Yes.
So this is what it's called by Mus'haf. The plural of sahife connotes a leaf or folio, which same it shows to the meaning of two covers and between having sheets of written text. And we have a lot of narrations that during the time of the Holy Prophet and afterwards during the time of Khalifa's Khilafah, that they would come and say that bring me a hadith so we can make Mus'haf out of it. So the word Mus'haf being Quran was a later denomination, normally around the time of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. But before that, normally the word Mus'haf would mean anything that has sheets between with two covers in both ends. So this is what Mus'haf meant.
That's right. Different Qurans were recorded in the history, isn't it?
No, so when we say different Qurans were recorded, it's like, we are not saying the context of the Quran, the Arabic version of the Quran. The Quran is the same Quran that we have right now.
Okay.
There is no difference. The explanation is something else. For example, we have, we would say the Quran with the khat of Ali, the writings of Amir al-Mumineen alayhi salam, where the explanations would be there. But note that some verses have been deducted from it, for it would go against what the Quran itself it says, that the Quran, the protector of the Quran from being distorted is Allah.